Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show here in Sandpoint, Idaho. And listeners, today I have a very special treat for you. It's someone from my home state who knows as much about the changing of seasons and animals and times and light and everything related to wonderful changing systems and seasons of nature. I'm going to go ahead and introduce John Latimer. John, you are the staff phenologist at KAXE, that's in Grand Rapids, and I think also in Bemidji, Minnesota. Do I have that right?
You do. We broadcast from radio transmitters roughly 90 miles apart from Grand Rapids and Bemidji. So we cover pretty much the north half of the state.
Yes. You know, KRFY, my station, may be one of the newer community radio stations in the country. We're about 15 years old, 15 this year. But KAXE is the very oldest, isn't it?
We were the first rural radio station, community-based radio station in the nation. That's right. And we are celebrating our 50th birthday this year. April 27th, I think, is our birthday.
That's an amazing...
And so we are halfway through our 50th year, and I'm happy to report that I am just a month shy of my 47th year on the air.
I knew you were there in the beginning. That's an amazing number of years. What an honor to be with such a great community radio station. I really look up to you all and all your programming. I listen in from out here in Sandpoint, and I enjoy you a lot. John, go ahead and tell us about your background. How did you start observing nature on an annual and seasonal basis?
Well, I've always been observant. I was one of seven children, and I was the child in the car that always was pointing out the hawk on the telephone wire or the eagle soaring overhead or just the animal I saw running in the woods. So I've been an observer all my life, but I was I worked as a rural mail carrier. And here in northern Minnesota, that meant that every day I would load up my car and I would go for a drive. And in the beginning, I had, maybe a 70-mile mail route. And somewhere in that milieu of customers was waiting a woman who I hadn't met. But when I did, I was absolutely blown off my feet. Her name was Mary Barquist. She met me at the mailbox one spring day, probably just because I've been keeping track. It was probably in late March. And she remarked to me at the mailbox, "You know, I think I saw my first robin today." Now, I don't know about Sandpoint, but robins are sort of a harbinger of spring here. They migrate south, maybe not that far, maybe not clear out of the state, but we seldom see robins in the winter in northern Minnesota. So there is an annual day when robins begin to return. And she caught me on that day, and it left me kind of gobsmacked. And I started visiting with her once a week. I would bring her mail down to her house. It was not onerous duty because she lived on a beautiful Clearwater Lake called Deer Lake. She owned a long piece of land that was a long, narrow point. And you could sit in her house and you could see the lake out either side of the house on the east and on the west. And lovely place. Her husband had passed away. I stopped in once a week. We would have coffee. I would pet her standard-sized poodle, and we would talk about nature. And that was in 1983. And in that year, she gifted me a book at Christmas time that was about birds, I think the first one, but she gave me many books over the years and just encouraged me to learn about nature. I grew up the son of a forester and a farmer's daughter, And so both of them had understandings of nature, and I had a bit of an understanding, but really I hadn't done any serious work learning about nature. Once I met her, and the beginning then in January of 1984, I took my first note, and I've been taking notes every year since then, and every day since then. And I have now close to 60,000 individual notes, some just that, an individual note. Like today or this past week, I went out and looked for a little object called the goblin fern, which is minuscule. I mean, a big one is 3 inches tall, so they're not something that you would notice. And I will have a record of that, but I'm certain that I won't have every year, oh, the goblin fern is up again, because that was a one-time kind of a thing. So some of my records are like that, but some of my records, like, familiar trees in this area are trembling aspens, red maples, Norway pine, And many of those, I have 45, 46 years of records of when do they first come, when are the first flowers,
yes,
when are the first leaves coming out, when are they, you know, when are the leaves all the way out, when can I see the leaf stem, and that kind of detailed examination of a single organism.
Yes,
and
so,
I have,
so John, let's just help our listeners understand, what is this thing that you're telling us about that's happening? What for you was a series of observations and taking of notes, maybe you didn't know it by its name then, but we sure do now. And what do we call this scientific branch of natural study that you're doing? It's phenology. And
indeed.
Yes. And let's take a minute and just let listeners know, what exactly is this branch of science, phenology?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about phenology is that, well, let's define it. As I do my show, I start my show with the same sentence every time. And that is, it's time for the phenology show. Phenology is the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate. And that's a fancy way of saying that every year the plants and animals do the same things. They just don't do them at the same time, because some years it's spring is late in arriving and some years spring is early in arriving. So
yes,
it's basically a careful examination of the nature around you.
Absolutely. And you're maybe the very prime example of someone who's a dedicated phenologist, not just from your work as a rural mail carrier, but now after retirement. And you began to do this for us, and let's just have you go ahead and continue and share with us, what is it like a day in the life of a pretty dedicated phenologist? What does that look like for you?
Well, now that I'm retired, of course, I'm sort of free to do what I want. And past week, it included that field trip to go look for the goblin fern. But a typical day, I will get up and I just walking out of my house, my eyes are going to scan the surroundings. I'm going to look at, I have a plant in my front yard called pagoda dogwood. It's a dogwood. I'm sure if I were in your area, I could find a similar plant. But it's one that grows native in my yard, and I'll look at it. Does it have berries? Oh, it has berries, but you know what? They're not as many as yesterday. The birds have eaten some, so I make a note of that. Or I have a very organized, what I would call a phenology walk, and in my case, it's about a mile and three quarters, and I go from plant to plant, and I go by, I'm blessed to have a bald eagle's nest in my yard, and I go by that, and I make notes about that, make notes about all the plants that are on my list, and I have 46 different plants that I look at. And these are, in this case, these are individual plants. So, for example, right now, the red maples are just beginning to take on a color here in northern Minnesota. Not all of them, but some of the early ones. You remember those students in school that were always getting their work done well ahead of time, and then there was the rest of us that got them done on average, and then there were some that, you know, waited until the very end to get the thing done, and trees are no different. Some are very early and some are very late. But I look at two particular red maples.
Individuals, just two of the many. Okay.
Looking at this tree today, and tomorrow I'm going to look at this same tree, and I've got another maple just over there, and I'm going to look at that maple too. And in those cases, it is that particular organism. And that essentially is the best way to do phenology, to pick out a plant. And I'm not familiar with what you have growing around you, but I know that you're in a climate that probably has seasonal change.
Oh, it does. And so, we actually have quite a few of the same plants as are existing in northern Minnesota. I was shocked to learn that when I moved here. Not all, but many.
Yeah. Well, if I were going to begin phenology in Sandpoint, I would start in my yard. And some of you have, well, I have 40 acres, so I have a big yard, which is why it's a mile and a quarter walk, or three quarters walk. But, you know, you can do it right in your own yard, or you can do it on the block you live on. Just, you know, learn that. You don't even have to really learn the name of the plant. Just look at the same plant day in, day out, or week in and week out. In the summertime, I make two or three trips a week. Especially in the springtime when things are really changing, I'll make two or three trips a week, and then maybe midsummer when things are sort of just trucking along, I'll go once a week. And in the winter, after sort of freeze up and the tamaracks are done with their needles, and the last few willows shed their last leaves, well, then I go once a week again. But in the periods of transition, spring and fall, I usually go out twice, maybe three times a week, and walk the same walk, look at the same plants, and make observations. What's changed since I was here last?
Sure, year to year. And, you know, I've got two questions that come from what you just said. One is, do you try to only observe the native plants? I doubt that you'd. I imagine that's important, but not everything. And then my second question will be about things other than plants that you might be observing throughout the year.
Yes. So to your question about native plants, in my phenology trail, those are all native plants.
Okay.
But while I'm doing that walkabout, and I've told you now I have these two red maples that I look at every time I go out, I look at those two red maples. In between, I might see some wildflower that, like a black-eyed Susan, that I'm not keeping track of, but I'll make a side note. I'll be like, oh, and the black-eyed Susans are at their peak of bloom, or the wild sunflowers are done flowering, or this species of goldenrod has begun to bloom. These might not be things that I'm looking for in my records, but they are things that are happening that I'm walking by and observing.
Sure. Yeah, but your focus is native species and their change over season and year to year and over time, just to see how climate is affecting these natives.
Yep, pretty much. I do have... no, I don't, because I don't have any of these invasives growing on my land. But we have this local invasive that is called buckthorn.
Oh, we have that here, but not to the degree it is in Minnesota.
Yeah. So I observe buckthorn, and I keep notes on buckthorn, but I don't have them. They are not like, it's not that particular buckthorn bush right there, because I don't have one in my property. And if I did come across one, I would tear it out. So
yes, would have to.
But yeah, pretty much native, just because that's easy. But if you have, you know, if I had a 50-year-old catalpa tree, let's say, which is not native to this far north in Minnesota, I would keep track of it.
Okay.
I would certainly keep notes on it. I don't care so much whether they're native or non-native. Are they established? And can I get, you know, I guess the thing is you want to look at something and say, can I get 10 years of data out of this? Can I get 20 years? Is this tree going to live 100 years? You know,
sure.
So the longer you can get a data set from that same organism, the better the data set, the better the data from that set. Yeah.
Yes. And so then to carry that ahead, there are other, you know, seasonal and annual happenings that I know you keep track of, for example, ice out and first frost, things like that. Tell us about environmental things that you're keeping track of, and how about animals too?
Yes, well, I ice out, absolutely. Ice in, when does the lake freeze? When does the ice go off the lake? You must have the same situations there.
Yes.
When do I have my first? I have two records for frost. First frost below 32, and then what I call the first killing frost, which is anything below 29. And I have a little temperature sonde that is stuck outside in the little shelter area, and I use that to determine my temperature. So.
Yes.
It makes a recording every 30 seconds, and I can just look at it and go, oh, I got down to 28 last night at 3 in the morning, and I see that it's gone up to 41 today for a high. So I keep track of, not so much, that data's there. I don't put that into my data set, but I have that as a subset of data.
I get it.
So I have all this temperature data. If someone were, you know, intrepid and really wanted to do the work, they could match up the weather data that I've collected, which is rainfall and temperature, and they could match that up with my phenology notes.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, phenology is a science that's related to the study of plants. The other observations are peripheral, but they're not strictly phenology.
No, I no, anything can be phenology. If that thing has a measurable change during its life, during its year, for instance, white-tailed deer, I do a lot of work with school kids, and our white-tailed deer is sort of the predominant large ungulate here. And that animal, right now, this time of year, the fawns are going to lose their spots. That'll be noteworthy. All of them, all the fawns and all of the bucks and does, all of the mature deer will undergo a pelage change. They're going to go from summertime red fur to wintertime gray fur. That's another note. I will also note when the antlers are polished, when they're before that, whether they're growing. Now, you know, now is the season where they're covered in velvet and they're just about to start looking for shrubs to kind of rub that velvet off and polish their antlers as they prepare for fall. That's noteworthy. I note the arrival and the disappearance of birds. So,
yes,
this past week, we have seen the last of the rose-breasted grosbeak, which is one of our summer birds. Orioles are moving out of the area. Hummingbirds, we have the ruby-throated hummingbird here. And that is, the males have left. Usually around the middle of August, the males disappear. And now we're left with females and juveniles, and they are starting to disappear. And probably by typically the 15th or 16th of September, I will see my last hummingbird.
Yes.
I'll leave my feeders out for another 2 weeks just to make sure that laggard up there in, you know, Winnipeg, who got a late start, is going to have something to drink when he comes past me.
Yes. So. Here in Sandpoint, we don't have the ruby-throated. We do have three species of hummingbird, but maybe all of them have the males leave early, but it's well noted that the rufous hummingbird males take off pretty early in this area. Yes.
And if one of your listeners is, you know, if they are so moved, or maybe they're already keeping track. Some people do phenology without ever knowing that what they're doing is phenology.
Yes.
You could have a nice long record of ice in and ice out, and you'd think of it as a ice in, ice out record. But it's an excellent phenology record. And couple that with, I don't know, returning waterfowl. I always note the return of Canada geese, sandhill cranes, trumpeter swans, mallard ducks, wood ducks. You know, these birds that come back when water opens up.
Oh, and swallows. And swallows are pretty predictable, at least
tree
in this
swallows,
area.
Absolutely. We have tree swallows here. They are on my list. Northern flicker, which is a ground-feeding woodpecker.
Yes.
Yeah, and the emergence and disappearance of bears. Things like woodchucks, groundhogs, we call them.
Yes.
When do I see my first? When did I see my last? So all of those things go in.
Which leads
you know,
me...
Anything that,
oh, I was going to say, it leads me to two questions. One is, of course, forever people have been observing the happenings around them from year to year in order to survive. And I'm wondering, when did phenology become an ology? Has there been a word phenology for a long time?
Longer than you would suspect. My best recollection is the 1850s. I think was the term. The term was coined by some guy in Belgium or Netherlands or someplace in Europe, and coined the term phenology, phenomena, the study of repetitious phenomena, however you want to define it. But so it's been around for a long time. But when I first started in the 80s. If I typed in the word phenology into my computer, it auto-corrected to phrenology, which is a discredited science of head shapes.
Yes. Yeah. So, well, this leads me then to another question following up on the word phenology, because you mentioned the groundhog coming out, and so... Really, Groundhog Day, which is looking for the emergence of groundhogs, basically, that kind of is a phenological event, isn't it? Groundhog Day.
Well,
in a way.
Groundhog Day is an astronomical event, actually.
Ah.
It is the halfway point between the winter solstice and the spring equinox.
There you go.
February 2nd is exactly halfway between the two. And it was in the Catholic Church, they called it Candlemas Day, and the folks out in Punxsutawney came up with the idea of you know the groundhog coming out and whether or not he saw his shadow, and there was some science behind that, because typically that time of year weather systems take about a week to go through. If he comes out and it's high pressure. And you're going to have a week of high pressure, then you're going to have a week of low pressure, a week of high, a week of low, a week of high, a week of low. Suddenly, and 6 weeks later, you know, you're sort of at spring.
There you go.
And if he comes out in a low pressure and it's cloudy and he doesn't see his shadow, you know, then blah, 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 it's going to be this.
Yes.
Basically, that was sort of the idea there. But as far as groundhogs here in northern Minnesota, and I would bet, for your area as well, late March, early April.
Yes.
As early as I would expect to see one.
No February groundhogs. But it does lead...
No, they are pretty well sound asleep in February. And I don't know how they get Punxsutawney Phil to wake up, but...
Yeah, it's good.
If you could get a Groundhog Day on February 2nd here in Northern Minnesota, and I suspect in Sandpoint as well, you could probably handle that thing for 24 hours before it would wake up enough to bite you.
most likely.
When he did wake up, well, because he's a mammal, he will bite you.
No kidding. He has teeth. You know, another kind of wives' tale-y thing that I wanted to ask you about that I wonder how that relates to our modern day study of phonology is the Farmer's Almanac. Do you follow it, and where does its knowledge come from?
Well, I don't follow it. I have a friend who is a physicist and a meteorologist, and he studies atmospheric science as a physicist. And he is absolutely disdainful of the Farmer's Almanac. He puts no stock in it. And he's fond of saying that, you know, every year they predict that the winter is going to be harder and more involved than the previous or than average. And every year it turns out to be whatever it turns out to be.
So the Farmer's Almanac is not an example of phonology. It's an example of something
really,
else.
No.
Okay.
No.
Just had to ask.
Farmer's Almanac is a collection of wisdom garnered from years and years of observing. But as far as predicting whether or not you're going to have a mild or fierce winter based on the kinds of things that they use as their guide, it's guesswork. It's not science.
Yes, weather is weather. Hey, I'd like to talk about something very special and very dear to your heart, and something that you've been doing for a number of years now that I just think is fabulous. And you touched on it for a moment earlier, but it has to do with kids and schools and a really incredible program that you've been working on. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, wow. Several years ago, well, back in the early 90s, when I had only, you know, maybe 6 or 8 years of airtime and was just getting started, a teacher called me from a school district not too far away, about 70 miles away, and he asked me if I would come and talk to his fourth grade class about phonology. And that was the beginning. I talked to his class. There was another teacher there who taught fourth grade, that this other teacher taught fifth grade. And we started a relationship that went on for over 20 years. And at the same time, I started branching out to a few other schools in the general area of Grand Rapids, you know, within 60 to 80 miles. And at some point I thought, you know, this would be so cool if I could have a phonology network across the entire state. And so we wrote a proposal. We got funded by some lottery money in Minnesota. It's the LCCMR, the Legislative Citizens Committee, the Natural Resources MR, I don't know. Anyway,
yeah.
They were generous and gave us money. We started holding seminars around the state teaching teachers how to teach phonology in the classrooms. And from that, we developed a sort of a network of schools that run now from the far southeastern corner of the state all the way up to the northern border, as far east as Grand Marais, which, if you're not familiar with Minnesota, if you look at that point of land that goes up along Lake Superior, the last sort of major town on that highway that leads you into Canada to Thunder Bay is called Grand Marais, and that, there's a school there that reports, a bunch of schools in the Duluth area, in the Minneapolis area, in between Minneapolis and Grand Rapids, several more schools. So altogether, I think we have about 24 schools, and we're always looking for more. We're always excited to get new teachers. Simply what we do is we tell the teachers, you know, here's what we require of you. You need to give us a report of what you're seeing. It doesn't have to be weekly, but whenever you have the time, send us a report that tell us about what's happening in your area.
Yes, and I can tell you, I've heard many, many of these student reports, and KRFY Sandpoint listeners, you should know that they're oral reports that are recorded, and they're then played on KAXE. And John, tell us more about some of the delightful these reports are from these students.
Oh, my word. Those kids, it's just incredible. And really, as with any good educator, it has to do with the teacher. And usually, if I get a teacher who's interested in learning about phenology, teaching phenology to their students, I can tell in the first hour of dealing with that teacher if they're going to be good at it, because some of them just are excited about it. And those are the ones that do the best.
Yes.
And what they need to do, if you're a teacher in the Sandpoint, Idaho area, and you'd like to get started, I contact the radio station and they will get your contact to me. I will send you our curriculum and I will invite you to send reports from Idaho that we will play on the air. I guarantee it.
I may have some applicants for you, because we have some very excited environmental teachers here in the Sandpoint area.
Wow,
would be exciting.
If they would like to get started, I would be happy to help them get their feet on the ground and get going and begin to engage students, because there is really nothing that excites me and in some cases, and in a lot of cases, excites students.
Yes.
More than going out with someone who can point at a tree or a plant and say, that is whatever it happens to be. I mean, I wish I knew more about your area. I would say, you know, that's an oak.
Yes.
This is a spruce. That's a Norway. That's a pine. You know, those kinds of things, and give them names. You name things for children and they take possession of them. They remember those names. And I think one of the most gratifying things of doing this, and I've been doing this for over 20 years now, is when I'm talking to some of the teachers who've been with me from the beginning, they will tell me, you know, I ran into a kid the other day, he's a senior in high school now, and he said to me, you know, the best part about your class was phenology. That was my favorite subject.
Oh.
And if you get kids outside and you just start showing them the world and teaching them about, you know, how this relates to that, when this happens, you should look for that to happen. Now, you have, I know you do, and we have here the same, you're aware of this, but we have a large indigenous population in this part of the state. And those people, and the people around your area as well, the indigenous people there, undoubtedly, until the arrival of Europeans, their lives were phenology-based.
Yes.
They would look at a sign in nature, and around here, this time of year, they would see something happening, and they would be, it's time to move our camp to the ricing area. We've got to go collect our wild rice. Or in the springtime, this sign, we see this sign in nature, we've got to move our camp to the sugar bush. It's time to get ready to harvest sugar sap and make sugar. And so that was their life. I mean, they depended on the relationship that exists between plants and understanding those relationships and what they meant. So that plant, you might not eat it, you might not do anything with it. It might be just a plant you're familiar with. But when it does a certain thing to the experienced eye, they look at that and they go, time to do this.
Absolutely. Of course, here on the Pacific Coast, we have things like salmon runs and huckleberry seasons and even camas root. That's a native indigenous food in this region. So lots of interesting plants that were very important to humans for a long time and still are.
Yeah, kind of got off on a sidetrack there. But as far as students go, showing them that, telling them, teaching them that kind of stuff, it increases their appreciation of the natural world and of the people who actually, you know, lived here and understood this world way better than we ever will.
It's really true. But I've got to go back to the students for a moment, because you'll just really often hear the wonder and delight in the reports those kids give, and you can hear a little bit of showmanship sometimes. They're really enjoying being able to produce something for the radio. I mean, I think it is great for those kids in so many ways. I listen and I smile every single time. The best.
You know, it's not just about the science. It's not just about the observations. Some of my best teachers they take the kids out for a walk. We're going to go for a hike. We're going to do our observations. We're going to come back. They get in the classroom. They divide the classroom into like groups of four, and each group then is responsible for composing a report. So they've got to write together. They've got to put their ideas down and create a report. And then the groups will then talk about the report. This is writing. It's thinking. It's organizing. And then they have to sort of decide that was a really good paragraph you did on this part of the report. We're going to take that paragraph and we're going to include it. And we're going to take the paragraph from your group over here and include it because it's a good paragraph too. And we're going to put it all together. And when we're done, we have this one cohesive report. And then somebody from the classroom, and that's sort of up to the teachers how they want to do it, you know, they let that person speak. And in some classrooms, the teacher is really structured and each student gets a chance. Every week, it's a different student until everybody's had a chance and then maybe back through it again, you know. And in other classrooms, it's a reward. And in other classrooms, it's just this person wants to do it.
Yeah, it's a variety, but it sure is fun. Those kids are just a lot of fun to listen to, and you can tell that they're learning. Love it.
You never tire of it. And you hear the wonder in their voices. And as you say, sometimes you hear showmanship. They're learning public speaking. They're learning writing. They're learning science. They're learning a whole host of things. Math is a big part of it, you know? So that we saw a robin on this day. How does that compare to our average? Where's our mean? Where's our median? Where's our, you know, all of that. And then this is amazing. I had a second grade teacher who did nothing more than put up each month. She put up a graph, and on the bottom, she had the days of the month, 1 through 31. And on the side, she had temperature. And every day they read the temperature at a certain time during the day. These are second graders. And they would put a mark on their graph.
Wow.
And when I came to talk to them, these second graders were able to explain to me how to interpret a line graph.
Wow.
And that's like fifth and sixth grade math. And these kids, because they were responsible for putting the points on the map, on the graph, they were responsible for understanding it, and they did, you know?
Yeah.
There are so many teaching opportunities associated with science and with phenology especially.
Yes.
Because you do not have to be an expert.
No, you can observe what's interesting to you, and there's
exactly
so much interesting stuff out there. It's pretty fun.
Some people are fascinated by mushrooms. Me? I can take them or leave them. I know a half a dozen that are edible, and I watch for those, and all the others are just, there's another mushroom.
Yes, you know? Well, I've noticed that you're pretty interested in berries. I scarcely hear a summertime report that doesn't include some berry that's happening.
Yep, look at all of the berries. And
yes.
Sometimes, you know, the berries are not going to feed me, they're going to feed the bears.
So
sometimes
true.
Sometimes they're going to feed the birds, and
now,
sometimes they're going to feed me.
Yes. Now listen, you're obviously a resource for those of us who are interested in phenology, but are there other resources? Is there a national place people can go if they get on Google?
Yes.
Okay.
Google usanpn.org.
Okay. Good. And that's a place they can go.
NPN stands for National Phenology Network.
Okay.
And that's where, you know, when I'm talking to you about my mile and three quarter hike, that is all NPN work.
Ah.
So I am looking at a specific tree, a specific plant, a specific animal. I am looking at that one. And animals are more random. You know, you don't know when you're going to run into a bear or something else. That just happens kind of randomly. But all of the plants, you know, they're going to be there, and the birds that migrate, they're going to follow their pattern. And NPN will, there's a nice tutorial that'll tell you how to get started and how to set it up, and you can add plants once you get started. And if you're like me, I have my hike organized so that I start in one particular spot, and then I just walk. You know, I don't backtrack. I walk a certain path, and it just keeps building. So I've arranged all my plants in proper order. So I go from plant A to plant B to plant C, all the way around to, well, it would be, you know, 46 of them. So it's going to be A through Z plus 20 more.
That's right. And then that is compiled by this organization. Is that what you're telling us, that they're keeping track?
You have a pretty simple yes or no sort of a thing. If you look at one of their pages, you'll see, like, if it's a plant, if it's a tree, new leaf buds breaking is the first one, leaves is the second one, the third one is colored leaves, leaves falling, and then it goes to flowers, and it goes through flowers or flower buds. Flowers open, flowers, you know, flowers declining, no flowers, seeds, and then through fruits, seeds and fruits, and then through them in terms of, okay, the fruits are present, the fruits are ripe, the fruits are gone. Something's eaten them, or something, they fall into the ground.
Well, it's detailed then. It sounds like they have a category for everything that you can keep an eye on, really.
Right. And you know, you look at your particular plant, and like for me, I'm looking at trembling aspen right now. I could do my trembling aspen right here from the chair I'm sitting in, because I know that it's fully leafed out and there are no flowers and no fruits. All it is that aspen tree with the leaves on it. Okay. And so I could say leaves, and then there's a quantifier. Not, you don't have to do the numbers. You can just say leaves are present, or you can go leaves, and then 95% or more of the canopy is filled with leaves, which would be full leaf out, which happens like mid-June here. Usually by mid-June, the leaves are as developed as they're going to get, and through this time of year, they're just making sugar. And what will happen is eventually they'll turn color and fall off.
That's right.
Those notes will then come further down.
Well, this is kind of exciting for a few reasons. One is that it helps the budding, no pun intended, the budding phenologist just sort of learn how to observe maybe more than they already are. And then even though phenology can be something we enjoy just for ourselves in our tiny little microclimate, it's really so nice to know that the work you've done is going to be shared and hopefully used in some positive way.
Yeah, it's exciting. I don't want to brag on myself, but back in 2015, I met a scientist from Harvard University who asked me to come to Harvard.
Oh, my.
There was no other way I was getting there, believe me. But I had 35 years of data at that time, and they were interested in ground-proofing phenology models that they were constructing from cameras.
How
so
neat.
So they set a camera up and have it take a picture of whatever. In your area, it might be a forest, or it might be a desert area. It might could be anything. But they have a camera looking at that, and they solve the cameras take, you know, they use RGB, red, blue, green, to make the colors, and they would just solve the equation for green.
Oh.
How green is it?
Interesting. So interesting.
And once they decided that that was how they were going to do it, they needed some ground proof. They needed what I had, which was the evidence, the data, to compare against the pictures.
So
they could take a picture and read it for green and say, okay, it's this green. And then by using my data sets, they could say, okay, if we're looking at a stand of aspen and it's this green, what was John's observation at that point. What was he seeing on the aspens on the ground?
Ah, so they could put together their data from photographs with actual observation made by you.
Right.
Yes.
They wanted to proof their model.
Interesting.
And I was the proof.
Oh, how amazing. Yeah. How great.
Well, you know, when I started doing phenology, that was the furthest thing from my mind.
I can just imagine.
It took me a while to even realize that this was actually a legitimate.
Yes.
I thought one of my friends was spoofing me.
Leads me to a question. Do phenologists get together very often? Do you have the opportunity to talk with your cohort very often?
Not as often as we would like. We're an interesting group. I've met many of the phenologists here in the state. For several years, we had a sort of an annual gathering of phenologists, and we sort of drifted away from that. We were only 30 or 40 of us that would gather, and probably 10 of us were actual, like me, regular recorders of the observations. And we would oftentimes present, you know, on what we had discovered in our areas. But a lot of the people were just interested because it's kind of an interesting subject.
Sure.
And it's been 2 years since we gathered, and we are now in the process. We had a meeting last month, and we're going to have another meeting in October, and we're probably setting ourselves up for a gathering in the spring. Usually, I always want it to be later in April so that when we do gather, there are things to look at.
Sure.
Events are taking place.
Yes, that seems to make sense.
If you want to break it down, in March and early April, what you have basically are bird migrations and one or two very early flowering plants. We have this one plant called speckled alder, which flowers really early in the spring.
We have that alder also.
Wonderful.
We do. I was just cutting a bunch off of a trail the other day. It can sure grow.
Yeah. Is yours the Ulnus rugosa or is it the Viridis, the green one?
That I do not know. I'm sorry.
Does yours get fairly tall?
Yes.
10, 12, 15 feet?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, if it's anything like our local, that would be the speckled, the rugosa.
Yes.
The other one, I think it's Viridis, I'm not sure, it's called green alder. It's around here, I seldom see it more than about 6 feet tall.
No, this one I was cutting more than 10 feet, ones that were more than 10 feet tall.
Yeah, that sounds like the same
rugosa
stuff we've got. Got these little cones on it. I'm reluctant to call them pine cones because it's not a pine.
Exactly. Those little.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. Little brown cones.
Right. That's
cones.
It.
Yep.
Well, listen.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. That's a fun one to watch, actually.
It is. It's a healthy plant around here.
That's a good one to do phenology on.
There you go.
Because it's got a lot of great stages. And it's the first flower in the spring that I can find, that I can get to throw pollen.
Now, I want to talk.
Usually that's early April.
April. So it is a good one to watch because it's going to let us know that spring is getting going.
Yep.
I wanted to ask you this question. I did text this to you earlier. I don't know if you've had a chance to think about it, but is there anything really peculiar, and even maybe among your more committed associates of and students of phenology, do you have any like kind of quirky or peculiar thing that you keep track of from year to year that maybe not everybody else is keeping their eye on, or just something funny maybe?
You know, you sent me a copy, and the first thing that came to mind was I keep track of the first. I keep track of the first mosquito bite I get. I keep track of the first deer fly bite I get.
Oh, boy.
I keep track of the first horse fly bite I get. I keep track of when they disappear, the last of all three of those.
What about the ticks? I suppose wood ticks, too.
I generally don't keep track of ticks, but I have a very good friend who sent me a note a week ago or so where he had 299 wood ticks this year and five deer ticks.
Oh, my. And you told me you told me that you're really light on mosquitoes this year, which is very unusual for Minnesota.
Yeah, we are, this part of Minnesota, we are sort of north central. If you're looking at the state, a little bit like find the tip of Lake Superior where the city of Duluth is, and we're just a little bit north of west of due west, maybe 10 or 15 degrees north of due west and about 80 miles inland from Duluth. And we have been in drought for several years.
Oof.
And we are, this last month I had fewer than 2 inches and of rain in August, and normally I would have close to four. July, I came as close to average as I have in any month, and I had three as opposed to almost four. In June, I had 0.7 inches. Hmm. And June is our rainiest month, and we would normally have 4.25 inches.
That's so very bad.
Yes.
Tough.
It's really dry. But to that end, this year when I recorded my first mosquito bite, I checked back, and I was 44 days later than average.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is like, where have you been, mosquitoes? I don't even remember you practically, yeah.
You wouldn't be able to say you were missing them, but that is very, that's very strange, yeah. And not good. Well,
I was out yesterday really quickly for a walk, and I was walking along about a quarter mile into my walk, and I thought to myself, I shouldn't say this, and I actually, in the note that I recorded to remind me of the moment, I recorded, I shouldn't be saying this, but I haven't been assaulted by a deer fly yet.
Oh, my.
And normally, the deer flies would be, you know, present and making themselves known, but there still are a few around. It'll be another week or so before they disappear for good, but...
Oh, okay.
We'll be happy when that happens.
This climate is lucky to not have quite as many of the biting insects. But interestingly, there are a lot of Minnesotans who've moved to North Idaho, and we all have our share of insect stories that we pass around. So anyway, hey, I have a friend who listens in, and I will often bounce my subjects and guests off on. And he's a person who always likes to try to create a funny moment in my interview. I must be so boring that he's trying to lighten the mood in the room for my poor listeners. But he came up with what he thought was a phenology joke. So are you ready for it?
Absolutely.
Oh, good. Here it is. Why did the phenologist get divorced?
Why did the phenologist get divorced?
Any guesses?
Just give me a second. I was playing this game with some kids earlier today. Let me think. Why did the phenologist get divorced? No, I'm not getting
coming
there.
Up with anything. Okay, well, his answer is because he started dating plants. It's pretty good, really, I think.
I like it, yes.
I do, too. Yes. That's a shout-out to my friend Gary for that homemade joke, anyway.
All right, Gary, thank you. I'm sure you and I would we'd have a great time chatting together.
There you go. Well, John.
Maybe we could go out and date plants together.
There you go. Well, I don't really have anything else for today. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Boy, not very much. I think we have really had a nice chat. I've so enjoyed this. I would encourage any of your listeners who might be interested in phenology, get in touch with you, or they can get in touch with me. You can give them my email address.
Will do.
If they want to talk phenology, have them put phenology in the subject line. I hate to say it over the air, but if I see phenology in the subject line, I'm likely to open it up.
Oh, good.
Otherwise, sometimes I get emails and I go, I don't know this name. I'm not opening this one. So.
Yes, yes. Well, listeners, it's kaxe.org. And on that site, you can... one is able to find John Latimer's email. So that would be a fast way if you want to reach out to him. But John, I am going to reach out to the folks that I know here in the schools and see if I can get some of them to reach out to you. And see if we can get things moving. That'd be cool.
And especially, you know, if we can discuss a little bit and you have the same plants that we do.
Like
we had one year I met a teacher from Massachusetts, and for 2 years she sent us notes from Massachusetts, and it was astonishing how close to the same time it existed at Massachusetts as at Minnesota. A little bit south of us. Sandpoint is up in the panhandle?
Yes, we're like 46 point something up here.
I'm at 47.3.
Okay.
So we would be very close.
Yes, yes.
And it would be really interesting if there are similar species back and forth that we could look at.
Boy, I think so too.
And say, this is what's happening here, and here's when it happens there. And why the difference? What's different?
That would be an interesting conversation. Well,
I'd love to be part of it.
I would love to have you. I think the listeners would too. Well, listen, we've just about run out of time, so I'm going to thank you. And for those of you joining us late, this has been John Latimer, and he is the staff phenologist at KAXE, community radio station in northern Minnesota that carries on day-to-day and week-to-week presentations about this topic of phenology. And if you're interested, you can go to kaxe.org or listen again to this interview, which will be up as a podcast after we play the interview. So anyway, I hope you all enjoyed it. And John, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
It was my pleasure as well. Thank you so much for having me.